one as cool as he could. Yes, there was a spec op laid on to take this Chinese missile farm down, and so he expected to see some hot flashes on the screen, and okay, all of them so far had been on the ground.
That should be all of them, the general announced.
Sir, this one's moving. This one's a launch.
Are you sure?
Look, sir, the bloom is moving off the site, she said urgently. Valid launch, valid launch, valid threat, she concluded.
Oh, my God.
Oh, shit, Sink Norad said.
He took one breath and lifted the gold phone.
No, first he'd call the NMCC.
The senior watch officer in the National Military Command Center was a Marine one-star named Sullivan. The NORAD phone didn't ring very often.
NMCC, Brigadier General Sullivan speaking.
This is Sink NORAD. We have a valid launch, valid threat from Xuanwan Missile Base in China. I say again, we have a valid launch, valid threat from China. It's angling east, coming to North America.
Fuck, the Marine observed.
Tell me about it.
The procedures were all written down. His first call went to the White House military office. Ryan was sitting down to dinner with the family. An unusual night, he had nothing scheduled, no speeches to give, and that was good, because reporters always showed up and asked questions. And lately...
Say that again, Andrea Price O'Day said into her sleeve microphone.
What?
Then another Secret Service agent bashed into the room.
"Marching order," he proclaimed.
It was a code phrase often practiced but never spoken in reality.
"What?"
Jack said, half a second before his wife could make the same sound.
"Mr. President, we have to get you and your family out of here," Andrea said. "The Marines have the helicopters on the way."
"What's happening?"
"Sir, NORAD reports an inbound ballistic threat."
"What, China?"
"That's all I know. Let's go, right now," Andrea said forcefully.
"Jack!"
Kathy said in alarm.
"Okay, Andrea." The president turned.
"Time to go, honey, right now."
"But what's happening?"
He got her to her feet first and walked to the door. The corridor was full of agents. Trenton Kelly was holding Kyle Daniel. The lionesses were nowhere in sight. And the principal agents for all the other kids were there. In a moment, they saw that there was not enough room in the elevator. The Ryan family rode. The agents mainly ran down the wide, white marble steps to the ground level.
"Wait!"
another agent called, holding his left hand up. His pistol was in his right hand, and none of them had seen that very often. They halted as commanded. Even the president doesn't often argue with a person holding a gun. Ryan was thinking as fast as he knew how.
"Andrea, where do I go?"
"You go to NECAP. Vice President Jackson will join you there. The family goes to Air Force One."
At Andrews Air Force Base, just outside Washington, the pilots of First Heli, the USAF First Helicopter Squadron, were sprinting to their Bell Hueys. Each had an assignment, and each knew where his principal was, because the security detail of each was reporting in constantly. Their job was to collect the cabinet members and spirit them away from Washington to preselected places of supposed safety. Their choppers were off the ground in less than 3 minutes, scattering off to different preselected pickup points.
"Jack, what is this?"
It took a lot to make his wife afraid, but this one had done it.
"Honey, we have a report that a ballistic missile is flying toward America, and the safest place for us is to be in the air. So they're getting you and the kids to Air Force One. Robbie and I will be on NECAP, okay?"
"Okay. Okay, what is this?"
"It's bad, but that's all I know."
On the Aleutian island of Shemya, the huge Cobra Dane radar scanned the sky to the north and west. It frequently detected satellites, which mainly fly lower than ICBM warheads. But the computer that analyzed the tracks of everything that came into the system's view categorized this contact as exactly what it was. Too high to be a low-orbit satellite, and too slow to be a launch vehicle.
"What's the track?" a major asked a sergeant.
"Computer says east coast of the United States. In a few minutes we'll know more. For now, somewhere between Buffalo and Atlanta."
That information was relayed automatically to NORAD and the Pentagon.
The entire structure of the United States military went into hyperdrive, one segment at a time, as the information reached it. That included USS Gettysburg, alongside the pier in the Washington Navy Yard. Captain Blandy was in his in-port cabin when the growler phone went off.
"Captain speaking. Go to general quarters, Mr. Gibson," he ordered, far more calmly than he felt. Throughout the ship, the electronic gonging started, followed by a human voice. "General quarters, general quarters, all hands man your battle stations."
Gregory was in CIC running another simulation.
"What's that mean?"
Senior Chief Leak shook his head.
"Sir, that means something ain't no simulation no more."
"Battle stations alongside the fucking pier?"
"Okay, people, let's start lighting it all up," he ordered his sailors.
The regular presidential helicopter muttered down on the south lawn, and the Secret Service agent at the door turned and yelled, "Come on!" Kathy turned.
"Jack, you coming with us?"
"No, Kath, I have to go to kneecap. Now get along. I'll see you later tonight, okay?"
He gave her a kiss, and all the kids got a hug except for Kyle, whom the president took from Kelly's arms for a quick hold before giving him back.
"Take care of him," he told the agent.
"Yes, sir. Good luck."
Ryan watched his family run up the steps into the chopper, and the Sikorsky lurched off before they could have had a chance to sit and strap down. Then another Marine helicopter appeared, this one with Colonel Dan Malloy at the controls. This one was a VH-60, whose doors slid open. Ryan walked quickly to it, with Andrea Price O'Day at his side. They sat and strapped down before it lumbered back into the air.
"What about everybody else?" Ryan asked.
"There's a shelter under the east wing for some," she said.
Then her voice trailed off, and she shrugged.
"Oh, shit, what about everybody else?" Ryan demanded.
"Sir, I have to look after you."
"But what?"
Then Special Agent Price O'Day started retching. Ryan saw and pulled out a barf bag, one with a very nice presidential logo printed on it, and handed it to her. They were over the mall now, just passing the George Washington Monument. Off to the right was Southwest Washington, filled with the working and middle-class homes of regular people who drove cabs or cleaned up offices, tens of thousands of them. There were people visible in the mall, on the grass, just enjoying a walk in the falling darkness, just being people.
"And you just left behind 100 or so.
Maybe 20 will fit in the shelter under the east wing.
What about the rest?
The ones who make your bed and fold your socks and shine your shoes and serve dinner and pick up after the kids. What about them, Jack?"
A small voice asked. "Who flies them off to safety?"
He turned his head to see the Washington Monument, and beyond that the reflecting pool and the Lincoln Memorial. He was in the same line as those men, in the city named for one, and saved in time of war by another. And he was running away from danger, the Capitol building, home of the Congress. The light was on atop the dome. Congress was in session, doing the country's work, or trying to, as they did. But he was running away. Eastern Washington, mainly black, working-class people who did the menial jobs for the most part, and had hopes to send their kids to college so that they could make out a little better than their parents had, eating their dinner, watching TV, maybe going out to a movie tonight or just sitting on their porches and shooting the bull with their neighbors. Ryan's head turned again, and he saw the two gray shapes at the Navy Yard, one familiar, one not, because Tony Brutano had... Ryan flipped the belt buckle in his lap and lurched forward, knocking into the Marine sergeant in the jump seat. Colonel Malloy was in the right front seat, doing his job flying the chopper. Ryan grabbed his left shoulder. The head came around.
"Yes, sir, what is it?"
"See that cruiser down there?"
"Yes, sir."
"Land on it."
"Sir, I..."
"Land on it, that's an order!" Ryan shouted at him.
"Aye, aye," Malloy said, like a good Marine.
The Black Hawk turned, arcing down the Anacostia River, and flaring as Malloy judged the wind. The Marine hesitated, looking back one more time. Ryan insistently jerked his hand at the ship.
The Black Hawk approached cautiously.
"What are you doing?" Andrea demanded.
"I'm getting off here. You're going to kneecap."
"No!" she shouted back. "I stay with you."
"Not this time. Have your baby. If this doesn't work out, I hope the kid turns out like you and Pat." Ryan moved to open the door. The Marine sergeant got there first. Andrea moved to follow.
"Keep her aboard, Marine," Ryan told the crew chief. "She goes with you."
"No!"
Price O'Day screamed.
"Yes, sir," the sergeant acknowledged, wrapping his arms around her.
President Ryan jumped to the non-skid decking of the cruiser's landing area and ducked as the chopper pulled back into the sky. Andrea's face was the last thing he saw. The rotor wash nearly knocked him down, but going to one knee prevented that. Then he stood up and looked around.
"What the hell is—"
"Jesus, sir," the young petty officer blurted, recognizing him.
"Where's the captain?"
"Captain's in CIC, sir. Show me." The petty officer led him into a door, then a passageway that led forward. A few twists and turns later, he was in a darkened room that seemed to be set sideways in the body of the ship. It was cool in here. Ryan just walked in, figuring he was President of the United States, Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, and the ship belonged to him anyway. It took a stretch to make his limbs feel as though they were a real part of his body, and then he looked around, trying to orient himself. First he turned to the sailor who'd brought him here.
"Thanks, son. You can go back to your place now."
"Aye, sir."
He turned away as though from a dream, nightmare, and resumed his duties as a sailor.
"Okay," Jack thought, "now what?"
He could see the big radar displays set fore and aft, and the people sitting sideways to look at it. He headed that way, bumping into a cheap aluminum chair on the way, and looked down to see what looked like a Navy chief petty officer in a khaki shirt whose pocket... well, damn. Ryan exercised his command prerogative and reached down to steal the sailor's cigarette pack. He lifted one out and lit it with a butane lighter. Then he walked to look at the radar display.
"Jesus, sir," the chief said belatedly.
"Not quite. Thanks for the smoke." Two more steps and he was behind a guy with silver eagles on his collar. That would be the captain of USS Gettysburg. Ryan took a long and comforting drag on the smoke.
"God damn it, there's no smoking in my CIC," the captain snarled.
"Good evening, Captain," Ryan replied. "I think at this moment we have a ballistic warhead inbound on Washington, presumably with a thermonuclear device inside. Can we set aside your concerns about secondhand smoke for a moment?"
Captain Blandy turned around and looked up, his mouth opened as wide as a U.S. Navy ashtray.
"How? Who? What?"
"Captain, let's ride this one out together, shall we?"
"Captain Blandy, sir,"
the man said, snapping to his feet.
"Jack Ryan, Captain."
Ryan shook his hand and bade him sit back down.
"What's happening now?"
"Sir, the NMCC tells us that there's a ballistic inbound for the East Coast. I've got the ship at battle stations. Radar's up."
"Ship inserted?" he asked.
"The chip is in, sir," Senior Chief Leak confirmed.
"Chip?"
"Just our term for it. It's really a software thing," Blandy explained.
Kathy and the kids were pulled up the steps and hustled into the forward cabin. The colonel at the controls was in an understandable hurry. With 3 and 4 already turning, he started engines 1 and 2, and the VC-25 started rolling the instant the truck with the steps pulled away, making one right-angle turn, and then lumbering down runway 19 right into the southerly wind. Immediately below him, Secret Service and Air Force personnel got the first family strapped in. And for the first time in 15 minutes, the Secret Service people allowed themselves to breathe normally. Not 30 seconds later, Vice President Jackson's helicopter landed next to the E-4B National Emergency Airborne Command Post, whose pilot was as anxious to get off the ground as the driver of the VC-25. That was accomplished in less than 90 seconds. Jackson had never strapped in, and stood to look around.
"Where's Jack?" the vice president asked.
Then he saw Andrea, who looked as though she just miscarried her pregnancy.
"He stayed, sir.
He had the pilot drop him on the cruiser in the Navy Yard.
He did what?
You heard me, sir.
Get him on the radio, right now, Jackson ordered.
Ryan was actually feeling somewhat relaxed. No more rushing about. Here he was, surrounded by people calmly and quietly going about their jobs. Outwardly so, anyway. The captain looked a little tense, but captains were supposed to, Ryan figured, being responsible in this case for $1 billion worth of warship and computers.
Okay, how are we doing?
Sir, the inbound, if it's aimed at us, is not on the scope yet.
Can you shoot it down?
That's the idea, Mr. President, Blandy replied.
Is Dr. Gregory around?
Here, Captain, a voice answered. A shape came closer.
Jesus!
That's not my name. I know you, Ryan said in considerable surprise. Major... Gregory, sir, I ended up a half a colonel before I pulled the plug. SDIO. Secretary Britano had me look into upgrading the missiles for the Aegis system, the physicist explained. I guess we're going to see if it works or not.
What do you think? Ryan asked.
It worked fine on the simulations, was the best answer available.
Radar contact. We got us a bogey, a petty officer said. Bearing 349er, range 900 miles, speed...
That's the one, sir.
Speed is 1,400 knots. I mean, 14,000 knots, sir.
Damn, he didn't have to add. 4.5 minutes out, Gregory said.
Do the math in your head? Ryan asked.
Sir, I've been in the business since I got out of West Point.
Ryan finished his cigarette and looked around for...
Here, sir.
It was the friendly chief with an ashtray that had magically appeared in CIC.
Want another one?
Why not? The president reasoned.
He took a second one, and the senior chief lit it up for him.
Thanks.
Gee, Captain Blandy, maybe you're declaring a blanket amnesty?
If he isn't, I am, Ryan said.
Smoking lamp is lit, people, Senior Chief Leak announced, an odd satisfaction in his voice.
The captain looked around in annoyance, but dismissed it.
4 minutes. It might not matter a whole lot, Ryan observed as coolly as the cigarette allowed.
Health hazard or not, they had their uses.
Captain, I have a radio call for the president, sir.
Where do I take it? Jack asked.
Right here, sir, yet another chief said, lifting a phone-type receiver and pushing a button.
Ryan?
Jack, it's Robbie.
My family get off okay?
Yeah, Jack, they're fine. Hey, what the hell are you doing down there?
Riding it out.
Robbie, I can't run away, pal. I just can't.
Jack, if this thing goes off...
Then you get promoted, Ryan cut him off.
You know what I'll have to do? The vice president demanded.
Yeah, Robbie, you'll have to play catch-up. God help you if you do.
But it won't be my problem, Ryan thought.
There was some consolation in that. Killing some guy with a gun was one thing. Killing a million with a nuke... No, he just couldn't do that without eating a gun afterward.
You're just too Catholic, Jack, my boy.
Jesus, Jack, his old friend said over the digital, encrypted radio link. Clearly thinking about what horrors he'd have to commit, son of a preacher man or not.
Robbie, you're the best friend any man could hope to have.
If this doesn't work out, look after Kathy and the kids for me, will you?
You know it.
We'll know in about 3 minutes, Rob. Get back to me then, okay?
Roger, the former Tomcat driver replied. Out.
Dr. Gregory, what can you tell me?
Sir, the inbound is probably their equivalent of one of our old W-51s. 5 megatons, thereabouts. It'll do Washington and everything within 10 miles. Hell, it'll break windows in Baltimore.
What about us here?
No chance. Figure it'll be targeted inside a triangle defined by the White House, the Capitol building, and the Pentagon. The ship's keel might survive, only because it's underwater.
No people.
Oh, maybe some really lucky folks in the D.C. subway. That's pretty far underground. But the fires will suck all the air out of the tunnels, probably.
He shrugged.
This sort of thing's never happened before. You can't say for sure until it does.
What chances that it'll be a dud?
The Pakistanis have had some failed detonations. We had fizzles once, mainly from helium contamination in the secondary. That's why the terrorist bomb at Denver fizzled.
I remember.
Okay, Gregory said. It's over Buffalo now. Now it's re-entering the atmosphere. That'll slow it down a little.
Sir, the track is definitely on us, the NMCC says, a voice said.
Agreed, Captain Blandy said.
Is there a civilian alert? Ryan asked.
It's on the radio, sir, a sailor said. It's on CNN, too.
People will be panicking out there, Ryan murmured, taking another drag.
Probably not. Most people don't really know what the sirens mean, and the rest won't believe the radio, Gregory thought.
Captain, we're getting close.
The track crossed over the Pennsylvania-New York border.
System up? Blandy asked.
We are fully online, sir, the weapons officer answered. We are ready to fire from the forward magazine. Firing order is selected, all block fours.
Very well.
The captain leaned forward and turned his key in the lock.
System is fully enabled. Special auto.
He turned.
Sir, that means the computer will handle it from here.
Target range is now 300 miles, a kid's voice announced.
They're so cool about this, Ryan thought. Maybe they just don't believe it's real.
Hell, it's hard enough for me. He took another drag on the cigarette, watching the blip come down, following its computer-produced velocity vector right for Washington, D.C.
Any time now, the weapons officer said.
He wasn't far off.
Gettysburg shuddered with the launch of the first missile.
One away, a sailor said off to the right. One is away clean.
Okay.
The SM-2ER missile had two stages. The short booster kicked the assembly out of its silo-type hole in the forward magazine, trailing an opaque column of gray smoke.
The idea is to intercept at a range of 200 miles, Gregory explained. The interceptor and the inbound will rendezvous at the same spot and... zap!
Mainly farmland there, place you go to shoot pheasants, Ryan said, remembering hunting trips there in his youth.
Hey, I got a visual on the fucker, another voice called.
There was a TV camera with a 10-power lens slaved into the fire control radar, and it showed the inbound warhead, just a featureless white blob now, like a meteor, Ryan thought.
Intercept in 4, 3, 2, 1.
The missile came close, but exploded behind the target.
Firing 2.
Gettysburg shook again.
2 away clean,
the same voice as before announced.
It was over Harrisburg, Pennsylvania now, its speed down to 13,000 miles per hour.
Then a third missile launched, followed a second later by a fourth. In the special auto setting, the computer was expending missiles until it saw a dead target. That was just fine with everyone aboard.
Only 2 Block 4s left, Wepp said.
They're cheap, Captain Blandy observed.
Come on, baby.
Number 2 also exploded behind the target, the TV picture showed.
3, 2, 1, now.
So did number 3.
Oh, shit. Oh, my God, Gregory exclaimed.
That caused heads to snap around.
What? Blandy demanded.
The IR seekers, they're going for the centroid of the infrared source, and that's behind the inbound.
What?
Ryan asked, his stomach in an instant knot.
The brightest part of the target is behind the target. The missiles are going for that.
Oh, fuck, Dr. Gregory explained.
5 away.
6 away.
Both got off clean, the voice to the right announced again.
The inbound was over Frederick, Maryland now, doing 12,000 knots.
That's it, we're out of block 4s.
Light up the block 3s, Blandy ordered at once. The next 2 interceptors did the same as the first 2. Coming within mere feet of the target, but exploding just behind it, and the inbound was traveling faster than the burn rate of explosive in the standard 2ER missile warheads. The lethal fragments couldn't catch up.
Firing 7. Clean.
Gettysburg shook yet again.
That one's a radar, Homer, Blandy said, clenching his fist before his chest.
5 and 6 performed exactly as the 4 preceding them, missing by mere yards,
but a miss in this case was as good as a mile.
Another shudder.
8. Clean.
We have to get it before it gets to 5 or 6,000 feet. That's optimal burst height, Gregory said.
At that range, I can engage it with my 5-inch forward, Blandy said, some fear in his voice now.
For his part, Ryan wondered why he wasn't shaking. Death had reached its cold hand out for him more than once. The mall in London. His own home. Red October. Some nameless hill in Columbia. Some day it would touch him. Was this the day? He took a last drag on the smoke and stabbed it out in the aluminum ashtray.
Okay, here comes 7. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now!
Miss! Fuck!
9 away. 10 away, both clean.
We're out of missiles, the distant chief called out. This is it, guys.
The inbound crossed over the D.C. Beltway, Interstate Highway 695, now at an altitude of less than 20,000 feet, streaking across the night sky like a meteor, or so some people thought it was, pointing and calling out to those nearby. If they continued to look at it until detonation, their eyes would explode, and they would then die blind.
8 missed! Missed by a cunt hair! A voice announced angrily.
Clear on the TV, the puff of the explosion appeared mere inches from the target.
2 more to go, the weapons officer told them.
Aloft, the forward portside SPG-62 radar was pouring out X-band radiation at the target. The rising SM-2 missile, its rocket motor still burning, homed in on the reflected signal, focusing, closing, seeing the source of the reflected energy that drew it as a moth to a flame. A kamikaze robot the size of a small car, going at nearly 2,000 miles per hour, seeking an object going 6 times faster.
2 miles. 1 mile. 1,000 yards. 500. 100.
On the TV screen, the RV meteor changed to a shower of sparks and fire.
Yeah!
20 voices called as one. The TV camera followed the descending sparks. The adjacent radar display showed them falling within the city of Washington.
You're going to want to get people to collect those fragments. Some of them are going to be plutonium. Not real healthy to handle, Gregory said, leaning against a stanchion.
Looked like a skin-skin kill.
Oh, God, how did I fuck up my programming like that? He wondered aloud.
I wouldn't sweat it too bad, Dr. Gregory, Senior Chief Leak observed. Your code also helped the last one home in more efficient-like. I think I might want to buy you a beer, fella.
Chapter 61 Revolution The Last Chapter
As usual, the news didn't get back quickly to the place where it had actually started. Having given the launch order, Defense Minister Luo had little clue what to do next. Clearly, he couldn't go back to sleep. America might well answer his action with a nuclear strike of its own, and therefore his first rational thought was that it might be a good idea for him to get the hell out of Beijing. He rose, made normal use of his bathroom, and splashed water on his face. But then again his mind hit a brick wall. What to do? The one name he knew to call was Zhang Hansan. Once connected, he spoke very quickly indeed.
You did...
What happened, Luo? The senior minister without portfolio asked with genuine alarm.
Someone, Russians or Americans, I'm not sure which, struck at our missile base at Chuanhua, attempting to destroy our nuclear deterrent. I ordered the base commander to fire them off, of course, Luo told his associate minister, in a voice that was both defiant and defensive. We agreed on this in our last meeting, did we not?
Luo, yes, we discussed the possibility. You fired them without consulting with us?
Zhang demanded. Such decisions were always collegial, never unilateral.
What choice did I have, Zhang? Marshal Luo asked in reply. Had I hesitated a moment, there would have been none left to fire.
I see, the voice on the phone said. What is happening now?
The missiles are flying. The first should hit their first targets, Moscow and Leningrad, in about 10 minutes. I had no choice, Zhang.
I could not allow them to disarm us completely.
Zhang could have sworn and screamed at the man, but there was no point in that. What had happened, and there was no sense expending intellectual or emotional energy on something he could not alter.
Very well, we need to meet. I will assemble the Politburo. Come to the Council of Ministers building at once.
Will the Americans or Russians retaliate?
They cannot strike back in kind. They have no nuclear missiles. An attack by bombers would take some hours, Luo advised, trying to make it sound like good news. At his end of the connection, Zhang felt a chill in his stomach that rivaled liquid helium. As with many things in life, this one, contemplated theoretically in a comfortable conference room, was something very different now that it had turned into a most uncomfortable reality. And yet, was it? It was a thing too difficult to believe. It was too unreal. There were no outward signs. You'd at least expect thunder and lightning outside the windows to accompany news like this, even a major earthquake. But it was merely early morning, not yet 7 o'clock. Could this be real? Zhang padded across his bedroom, switched on his television, and turned it to CNN. It had been turned off for most of the country, but not here, of course. His English skills were insufficient to translate the rapid-fire words coming over the screen now. They were showing Washington, D.C. with a camera evidently atop the CNN building there. Wherever that was, he had not the faintest idea. It was a black American speaking. The camera showed him standing atop a building, microphone in hand like black plastic ice cream, speaking very, very rapidly. So much so that Zhang was catching only one word in three, and looking off to the camera's left with wide, frightened eyes. So he knows what is coming there, doesn't he? Zhang thought. Then wondered if he would see the destruction of the American capital via American news television. That, he thought, would have some entertainment value. Look, the reporter said, and the camera twisted to see a smoke trail race across the sky. What the hell is that? Zhang wondered. Then there was another, and more besides, and the reporter was showing real fear now. It was good for his heart to see such feelings on the face of an American, especially a black American reporter. Another one of those monkeys had caused his country such great harm after all. So now he'd get to see one incinerated. Or maybe not. The camera and the transmitter would go too, wouldn't they? So, just a flash of light, maybe. And a blank screen that would be replaced by CNN headquarters in Atlanta. More smoke trails. Ah, yes, they were surface-to-air missiles. Could such things intercept a nuclear missile? Probably not, Zhang judged. He checked his watch. The sweep hand seemed determined to let the snail win this race. It jumped so slowly from one second to the next. And Zhang felt himself watching the display on the TV screen with anticipation he knew to be perverse. But America had been his country's principal enemy for so many years, had thwarted two of his best and most skillfully laid plans. And now he'd see its destruction by means of one of its very own agencies, this cursed medium of television news. And though Tan Dashi claimed it was not an organ of the American government, surely that could not be the case. The Ryan regime in Washington must have a very cordial relationship with those minstrels. They followed the party line of the Western government so fawningly. Two more smoke trails. The camera followed them and... What was that? Like a meteor, or the landing light of a commercial aircraft, a bright light, seemingly still in the sky. No, it was moving. Unless that was the fear of the cameraman showing. Oh, yes, that was it, because the smoke trails seemed to seek it out. But not quite closely enough, it would seem. And so, farewell, Washington, Zhang Hansan thought. Perhaps there'd be adverse consequences for the People's Republic, but he'd have the satisfaction of seeing the death of... What was that? Like a bursting firework in the sky, a shower of sparks mainly heading down. What did that mean?
it was clear 60 seconds later. Washington had not been blotted from the map. Such a pity, Zhang thought, especially since there would be consequences. With that, he washed and dressed and left for the Council of Ministers building.
Dear God, Ryan breathed.
The initial emotions of denial and elation were passing now. The feelings were not unlike those following an auto accident. First was disbelief, then remedial action that was more automatic than considered. Then, when the danger was past, came the whiplash after fear, when the psyche started to examine what had passed and what had almost been, and fear after survival, fear after the danger was past, brought on the real shakes. Ryan remembered that Winston Churchill had remarked that there was nothing more elating than rifle fire that had missed. To be shot at without result was the exact quote the president remembered. If so, Winston Spencer Churchill must have had ice water in his cardiovascular system, or he enjoyed braggadocio more than this American president did.
"Well, I hope that was the only one," Captain Blandy observed.
"Better be, Captain. We be out of missiles," Chief Leak said, lighting up another smoke in accordance with the presidential amnesty.
"Captain," Jack said when he was able to, "every man on this ship gets promoted one step by presidential order, and USS Gettysburg gets a presidential unit citation. That's just for starters, of course. Where's a radio? I need to talk to Kneecap."
"Here, sir." A sailor handed him a phone receiver. "The line's open, sir."
"Robbie?"
"Jack?"
"You're still vice president," Swordsman told Tomcat.
"For now, I suppose."
"Christ, Jack, what the hell were you trying to do?"
"I'm not sure. It seemed like the right idea at the time." Jack was seated now, both holding the phone in his hand and cradling it between cheek and shoulder, lest he drop it on the deck.
"Is there anything else coming in?"
"NORAD says the sky is clear. Only one bird got off. Targeted on us. Shit, the Russians still have dedicated ABM batteries all around Moscow. They probably could have handled it better than us."
Jackson paused.
"We're calling in the nuclear emergency search team from Rocky Mountain Arsenal to look for hotspots. DOD has people coordinating with the DC police."
"Jesus, Jack, that was just a little intense, you know."
"Yeah, it was that way here, too."
"Now what?" the president asked.
"You mean with China?
Part of me says load up the B-2 bombers on Guam with the B-61 gravity bombs and send them to Beijing. But I suppose that's a little bit of an overreaction."
"I think some kind of public statement. Not sure what yet."
"What are you going to be doing?"
"I asked. The drill is for us to stay up for 4 hours before we come back to Andrews. Same for Kathy and the kids. You might want to call them, too."
"Roger."
"Okay, Robbie, sit tight. See you in a few hours. I think I'm going to have a stiff one or two."
"I hear that, buddy."
"Okay, POTUS out." Ryan handed the phone back.
"Captain?"
"Yes, Mr. President."
"Your entire ship's crew is invited to the White House, right now, for some drinks on the house. I think we all need it."
"Sir, I will not disagree with that."
"And those who stay aboard, if they feel the need to bend an elbow, as Commander-in-Chief, I waive Navy regulations on that subject for 24 hours.
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Chief," Jack said next.
"Here, sir."
He handed his pack and lighter over.
"I got more in my locker, sir."
Just then, two men in civilian clothes entered CIC. It was Hilton and Malone from the night crew.
"How'd you guys get here so fast?" Ryan asked.
"Andrea called us, sir. Did what we think happened just happen?"
"Yep, and your president needs a bottle and a soft chair, gentlemen."
"We have a car on the pier, sir. You want to come with us?"
"Okay.
Captain, you get buses or something and come to the White House right away. If it means locking the ship up and leaving her without anyone aboard, that's just fine with me. Call the Marine Barracks at 8th and I for security if you need to."
Aye, aye, Mr. President. We'll be along shortly.
I might be drunk before you get there, the President thought.
The car Hilton and Malone had brought down was one of the black armored Chevy Suburbans that followed the President everywhere he went. This one just drove back to the White House. The streets were suddenly filled with people simply standing and looking up. It struck Ryan as odd. The thing was no longer in the sky, and whatever pieces were on the ground were too dangerous to touch. In any case, the drive back to the White House was uneventful, and Ryan ended up in the Situation Room, strangely alone. The uniformed people from the White House military office, called WHAMO by the staff, which seemed particularly inappropriate at the moment, were all in a state somewhere between bemused and stunned. And the immediate consequence of the great effort to whisk senior government officials out of town, the scheme was officially called the continuation of government, had had the reverse effect. The government was at the moment still fragmented in 20 or so helicopters and one E-4B, and quite unable to coordinate itself. Ryan figured that the emergency was better designed to withstand a nuclear attack than to avoid one. And that, at the moment, seemed very strange. Indeed, the big question for the moment was, what the hell do we do now? And Ryan didn't have much of a clue. But then a phone rang to help him.
This is President Ryan.
Sir, this is General Dan Liggett at Strike Command in Omaha. Mr. President, I gather we just dodged a major bullet.
Yeah, I think you can say that, General.
Sir, do you have any orders for us?
Like what?
Well, sir, one option would be retaliation, and...
Oh, you mean because they blew a chance to nuke us, we should take the opportunity to nuke them for real?
Sir, it's my job to present options, not to advocate any, Liggett told his commander-in-chief.
General, do you know where I was during the attack?
Yes, sir.
Gutsy call, Mr. President.
Well, I am now trying to deal with my own restored life, and I don't have a clue what I ought to do about the big picture, whatever the hell that is. In another 2 hours or so, maybe we can think of something, but at the moment I have no idea at all. And you know, I'm not sure I want to have any such idea. So for the moment, General, we do nothing at all. Are we clear on that?
Yes, Mr. President.
Nothing at all happens with Strike Command.
I'll get back to you.
Jack?
A familiar voice called from the door.
Arnie, I hate drinking alone, except when there's nobody else around. How about you and me drain a bottle of something? Tell the usher to bring down a bottle of Middleton, and, you know, have him bring a glass for himself.
Is it true you wrote it out on the ship down at the Navy Yard?
Yep.
Ryan bobbed his head.
Why?
I couldn't run away, Arnie. I couldn't run off to safety and leave a couple of million people to fry. Call it brave, call it stupid, I just couldn't bug out that way.
Van Damme leaned into the corridor and made the drink order to someone Jack couldn't see, and then he came back in.
I was just starting dinner at my place in Georgetown when CNN ran the flash. Figured I might as well come here. Didn't really believe it like I should have, I suppose.
It was somewhat difficult to swallow. I suppose I ought to ask myself if it was our fault, sending the special operations people in. Why is it that people second-guess everything we do here?
Jack, the world is full of people who can only feel big by making other people look small. And the bigger the target, the better they feel about it. And reporters love to get their opinions because it makes a good story to say you're wrong about anything. The media prefers a good story to a good truth most of the time. It's just the nature of the business they're in.
That's not fair, you know, Ryan observed, when the head usher arrived with a silver tray, a bottle of Irish whiskey, and some glasses with ice already in them.
Charlie, you pour yourself one, too, the President told him.
Mr. President, I'm not supposed... Today the rules changed, Mr. Pemberton. If you get too swacked to drive home, I'll have the Secret Service take you.
Have I ever told you what a good guy you are, Charlie? My kids just plain love you.
Charles Pemberton, son and grandson of ushers at the White House, poured three drinks,
just a light one for himself, and handed the glasses over with the grace of a neurosurgeon.
"Sit down and relax, Charlie. I have a question for you."
"Yes, Mr. President?"
"Where did you write it out? Where did you stay when that H-bomb was coming down on Washington?"
"I didn't go to the shelter in the East Wing. Figured that was best for the women folk. Well, sir, I took the elevator up to the roof and figured I'd just watch."
"Arnie, there sits a brave man," Jack said, saluting with his glass.
"Where were you, Mr. President?" Pemberton asked, breaking the etiquette rules because of pure curiosity.
"I was on the ship that shot the damn thing down, watching our boys do their job. That reminds me, this Gregory guy, the scientist that Tony Brentano got involved. We look after him, Arnie. He's one of the people who saved the day."
"Duly noted, Mr. President."
Van Damme took a big pull on his glass.
"What else?"
"I don't have a what else right now," Swordsman admitted. Neither did anyone in Beijing, where it was now 8 in the morning, and the ministers were filing into their conference room like sleepwalkers, and the question on everyone's lips was, "What happened?" Premier Xu called the meeting to order and ordered the defense minister to make his report, which he did in the monotone voice of a phone recording.
"You ordered the launch?"
Foreign Minister Shen asked, aghast.
"What else was I to do? General Shun told me his base was under attack. They were trying to take our assets away. We spoke of this possibility, did we not?"
"We spoke of it, yes," Shen agreed. "But to do such a thing without our approval? That was a political action without reflection, Luo. What new dangers have you brought on us?"
"And what resulted from it?"
Fang asked next. "Evidently the warhead either malfunctioned or was somehow intercepted and destroyed by the Americans. The only missile that launched successfully was targeted on Washington. The city was not, I regret to say, destroyed."
"You regret to say? You regret to say?"
Fang's voice spoke more loudly than anyone at the table could ever remember.
"You fool! If you had succeeded, we would be facing national death now. You regret?"
At about that time in Washington, a mid-level CIA bureaucrat had an idea. They were feeding live and taped coverage from the Siberian battlefield over the Internet, because independent news coverage wasn't getting into the People's Republic. "Why not," he asked his supervisor, "send them CNN as well?" That decision was made instantaneously, though it was possibly illegal, maybe a violation of copyright laws. But on this occasion, common sense took precedence over bureaucratic caution. CNN, they decided quickly, could bill them later. And so, 1 hour and 20 minutes after the event, HTTP, www.darkstarfeed.cia.gov/siberiabattle/realtime.ram, began to cover the coverage of the near destruction of Washington, D.C. The news that a nuclear war had been begun but aborted stunned the students in Tiananmen Square. The collective realization that they themselves might be the targets of a retaliatory strike did not put fear so much as rage into their young hearts. There were about 10,000 of them now, many with their portable laptop computers, and many of those hooked into cell phones for Internet access. From overhead you could tell their positions just by the tiny knots of pressed-together bodies. Then the leaders of the demonstration got together and started talking fast among themselves. They knew they had to do something, they just didn't know exactly what. For all they knew, they might well all be facing death. The ardor was increased by the commentators CNN had hurriedly rushed into their studios in Atlanta and New York, many of whom opined that the only likely action for America was to reply in kind to the Chinese attack. And when the reporter acting as moderator asked what in kind meant, the reply was predictable.
For the students, the question now was not so much life and death as saving their nation. The 1,300 million citizens whose lives had been made forfeit by the madmen of the Politburo. The Council of Ministers building was not all that far away, and the crowd started heading that way. By this time there was a police presence in the Square of Heavenly Peace. The morning watch replaced the night team and saw the mass of young people, to their considerable surprise, since this had not been a part of their morning briefing. The men going off duty explained that nothing had happened at all that was contrary to the law, and for all they knew, it was a spontaneous demonstration of solidarity and support for the brave PLA soldiers in Siberia. So there were few of them about, and fewer still of the people's armed police. It would probably not have mattered in any case. The body of students coalesced and marched with remarkable discipline to the seat of their country's government. When they got close, there were armed men there. These police officers were not prepared to see so many people coming toward them. The senior of their number, a captain, walked out alone and demanded to know who was in charge of this group, only to be brushed aside by a 22-year-old engineering student. Again, it was a case of a police officer totally unaccustomed to having his words disregarded, and totally nonplussed when it took place. Suddenly he was looking at the back of a young man who was supposed to have stopped dead in his tracks when he was challenged. The security policeman had actually expected the students to stop as a body at his command, for such was the power of law in the People's Republic. But strong as the force of law was, it was also brittle, and when broken, there was nothing behind it. There were also only 40 armed men in the building, and all of them were on the first floor in the rear, kept out of the way because the ministers wanted the armed peasants out of sight, except in ones and twos. The four officers on duty at the main entrance were just swept aside as the crowd thundered in through the double doors. All drew their pistols, but only one fired, wounding three students before being knocked down and kicked into senselessness. The other three just ran to the main post to find the reserve force. By the time they got there, the students were running up the wide, ceremonial stairs to the second floor. The meeting room was well soundproofed, a security measure to prevent eavesdropping. But soundproofing worked in both directions, and so the men sitting around the table did not hear anything until the corridor was filled with students only 50 meters away. And even then the ministers just turned about in nothing more than annoyance. The armed guard force deployed in two groups, one running to the front of the building on the first floor, the other coming up the back on the second, led by a major who thought to evacuate the ministers. The entire thing had developed much too quickly, with virtually no warning, because the city police had dropped the ball rather badly, and there was no time to call in armed reinforcements. As it played out, the first floor team ran into a wall of students, and while the captain in command had 20 men armed with automatic rifles, he hesitated to order opening fire because there were more students in view than he had cartridges in his rifles, and in hesitating he lost the initiative. A number of students approached the armed men, their hands raised, and began to engage them in reasonable tones that belied the wild-eyed throng behind them. It was different on the second floor. The major there didn't hesitate at all. He had his men level their rifles and fire one volley high, just to scare them off. But these students didn't scare. Many of them crashed through doors off the main corridor, and one of these was the room in which the Politburo was sitting. The sudden entrance of 15 young people got every minister's attention. "What is this?" Zhang Hansan thundered. "Who are you?" "And who are you?" the engineering student sneered back. "Are you the maniac who started a nuclear war?" "There is no such war. Who told you such nonsense?" Marshal Luo demanded. His uniform told them who he was. "And you are the one who sent our soldiers to their death in Russia?" "What is this?" the minister without portfolio asked. "I think these are the people, Zhang," Chan Kun observed. "Our people, comrade," he added coldly. Into the vacuum of power and direction, More of the students forced their way into the room, and now the guard force couldn't risk shooting. Too many of their country's leadership was right there, right in the field of fire.
"Grab them! Grab them! They will not shoot these men!" one student shouted.
Pairs and trios of students raced around the table, each to a separate seat.
"Tell me, boy," Fung said gently to the one closest to him, "how did you learn all this?"
"Over our computers, of course," the youngster replied, a little impolitely, but not grossly so.
"Well, one finds truth where one can," the grandfatherly minister observed.
"So, grandfather, is it true?"
"Yes, I regret to say it is," Fung told him, not quite knowing what he was agreeing to.
Just then the troops appeared, their officer in the lead with a pistol in his hand, forging their way into the conference room, wide-eyed at what they saw. The students were not armed, but to start a gunfight in this room would kill the very people he was trying to safeguard. And now it was his turn to hesitate.
"Now everyone be at ease," Fung said, pushing his seat gently back from the table.
"You, Comrade Major, do you know who I am?"
"Yes, Minister, but—"
"Good, Comrade Major. First, you will have your men stand down. We need no killing here. There has been enough of that."
The officer looked around the room. No one else seemed to be speaking just yet, and into that vacuum had come words which, if not exactly what he wanted to hear, at least had some weight in them. He turned, and without words, waving his hands, had his men relax a little.
"Very good. Now, comrades," Fung said, turning back to his colleagues, "I propose that some changes are needed here. First of all, we need Foreign Minister Shen to contact America and tell them that a horrible accident has occurred, and that we rejoice that no lives were lost as a result, and that those responsible for that mistake will be handled by us. To that end, I demand the immediate arrest of Premier Xu, Defense Minister Luo, and Minister Zhang. It is they who caused us to embark on the foolish adventure in Russia that threatens to bring ruin to us all. You three have endangered our country, and for this crime against the people you must pay. Comrades, what is your vote?" Fung demanded.
There were no dissents. Even Tan and Interior Minister Tong nodded their assent.
"Next, Shen, you will immediately propose an end to hostilities with Russia and America, telling them also that those responsible for this ruinous adventure will be punished. Are we agreed on that, comrades?"
They were.
"For myself, I think we ought all to give thanks to heaven that we may be able to put an end to this madness. Let us make this happen quickly. For now, I will meet with these young people to see what other things are of interest to them. You, Comrade Major, will conduct the three prisoners to a place of confinement. Chan, will you remain with me and speak to the students as well?"
"Yes, Fung," the finance minister said. "I will be pleased to."
"So, young man," Fung said to the one who'd seemed to act like a leader, "what is it you wish to discuss?" The Black Hawks were long on their return flight. The refueling went off without a hitch, but it was soon apparent that almost 30 men, all Russians, had been lost in the attack on Xuanhua. It wasn't the first time Clark had seen good men lost, and as before, the determining factor was nothing more than luck. But that was a lousy explanation to have to give to a new widow. The other thing eating at him was the missile that had gotten away. He'd seen it lean to the east. It hadn't gone to Moscow, and that was all he knew right now. The flight back was bleakly silent the whole way, and he couldn't fix it by calling in on his satellite phone because he'd taken a fall at some point and broken the antenna off the top of the damn thing. He'd failed. That was all he knew. And the consequences of this kind of failure surpassed his imagination. The only good news he could come up with was that no one in his family lived close to any likely target, but lots of other people did. Finally, the chopper touched down, and the doors were opened for the troopers to get out. Clark saw General Diggs there and went over to him.
How bad?
The Navy shot it down over Washington.
What?
General Moore told me. Some cruiser, Gettysburg, I think he said, shot the bastard down right over the middle of D.C. We got lucky, Mr. Clark.
John's legs almost buckled at that news. For the past 5 hours he'd been imagining a mushroom cloud with his name on it over some American city. But God, luck, or the great pumpkin had intervened, and he'd settle for that.
"What gives, Mr. C?" Chavez asked, with considerable worry in his voice.
Diggs gave him the word, too.
"The Navy? The fucking Navy? Well, I'll be damned. They are good for something, eh?"
Jack Ryan was about half in the bag by this time, and if the media found out about it, the hell with them. The cabinet was back in town, but he'd put off the meeting until the following morning. It would take time to consider what had to be done. The most obvious response, the one talking heads were proclaiming on the various TV stations, was one he could not even contemplate, much less order. They'd have to find something better than wholesale slaughter. He wouldn't order that, though some special operation to take out the Chinese Politburo certainly appealed to his current state of mind. A lot of blood had been spilled, and there would be some more, too. To think it had all begun with an Italian cardinal and a Baptist preacher, killed by some trigger-happy cop. Did the world really turn on so perverse an axis as that?
That, Ryan thought, calls for another drink. But some good had to come from this. You had to learn lessons from this sort of thing.
But what was there to learn? It was too confusing for the American president. Things had happened too fast. He'd gone to the brink of something so deep and so dreadful that the vast maw of it still filled his eyes. And it was just too much for one man to handle. He'd bounced back from facing imminent death himself, but not the deaths of millions. Not as directly as this. The truth of the matter was that his mind was blanked out by it all. Unable to analyze, unable to correlate the information in a way that would help him take a step forward. And all he really wanted and needed to do was to embrace his family, to be certain that the world still had the shape he wanted it to have. People somehow expected him to be a superman, to be some godlike being who handled things that others could not handle.
Well, yeah, Jack admitted to himself.
Maybe he had shown courage by remaining in Washington, but after courage came deflation, and he needed something outside himself to restore his manhood. The well he'd tapped wasn't bottomless at all, and this time the bucket was clunking down on rocks. The phone rang. Arnie got it.
"Jack, it's Scott Adler."
Ryan reached for it.
"Yeah, Scott, what is it?"
"Just got a call from Bill Kilmer, the DCM in Beijing. Seems that Foreign Minister Shen was just over to the embassy. They have apologized for launching the missile. They say it was a horrible accident, and they're glad the thing didn't go off."
"That's fucking nice of them," Ryan observed.
"Well, whoever gave the order to launch is under arrest. They request our assistance in bringing an end to hostilities. Shen said they'd take any reasonable action to bring that about. He said they're willing to declare a unilateral ceasefire and withdraw all their forces back to their own borders, and to consider reparations to Russia. They're surrendering, Jack."
"Really? Why?"
"There appears to have been some sort of riot in Beijing. Reports are very sketchy, but it seems that their government has fallen. Minister Fang Gan seems to be the interim leader. That's all I know, Jack, but it looks like a decent beginning. With your permission and with the concurrence of the Russians, I think we ought to agree to this."
"Approved," the president said, without much in the way of consideration. "Hell," he told himself, "you don't have to dwell too much on ending a war, do you?"
"Now what?"
"Well, I want to talk to the Russians to make sure they'll go along.
I think they will. Then we can negotiate the details. As a practical matter, we hold all the cards, Jack.
The other side is folding.
Just like that?
We end it all just like that? Ryan asked.
It doesn't have to be Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel, Jack. It just has to work.
Will it work?
Well, yes, Jack, it ought to.
Okay, get hold of the Russians, Ryan said, setting his glass down.
Maybe this was the end of the last war, Jack thought. If so, no, it didn't have to be pretty.
It was a good dawn for General Bondarenko, and was about to get better. Colonel Tolkunov came running into his command center holding a sheet of paper.
We just copied this off the Chinese radio, military and civilian. They are ordering their forces to cease fire in place and to prepare to withdraw from our territory.
Oh, what makes them think we will let them go?
The Russian commander asked.
It's a beginning, Comrade General. If this is accompanied by a diplomatic approach to Moscow, then the war will soon be over. You have won, the colonel added.
Have I?
Gennady Yosefovich asked.
He stretched. It felt good this morning, looking at his maps, seeing the deployments, and knowing that he held the upper hand. If this was the end of the war, and he was the winner, then that was sufficient to the moment, wasn't it?
Very well. Confirm this with Moscow.
It wasn't that easy, of course. Units in contact continued to trade shots for some hours, until the orders reached them. But then the firing died down, and the invading troops withdrew away from their enemies, and the Russians, with orders of their own, didn't follow. By sunset, the shooting and the killing had stopped, pending final disposition. Church bells rang all over Russia. Golovko took note of the bells and the people in the streets, swigging their vodka and celebrating their country's victory. Russia felt like a great power again, and that was good for the morale of the people. Better yet, in another few years, they'd start reaping the harvest of their resources. And before that would come bridge loans of enormous size. And maybe, just maybe, Russia would turn the corner, finally, and begin a new century well, after wasting most of the previous one. It was nightfall before the word got out from Beijing to the rest of China. The end of the war so recently started came as a shock to those who'd never really understood the reasons or the facts in the first place. Then came word that the government had changed, and that was also a puzzling development for which explanations would have to wait. The interim premier was Feng Gan, a name known from pictures rather than words or deeds, but he looked old and wise, and China was a country of great momentum rather than great thoughts. And though the course of the country could change, it would change slowly so far as its people were concerned. People shrugged and discussed the puzzling new developments in quiet and measured words. For one particular person in Beijing, the changes meant that her job would change somewhat in importance, if not in actual duties. Ming went out to dinner. The restaurants hadn't closed. With her foreign lover, gushing over drinks and noodles with the extraordinary events of the day. Then walked off to his apartment for a dessert of Japanese sausage. This concludes the reading of The Bear and the Dragon by Tom Clancy. Copyright 2000 by Rubicon Incorporated. This recording of the full-length reading of The Bear and the Dragon was published by arrangement with Rubicon Incorporated and was produced in 2000 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. This book was read by Michael Pritchard.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.